Laban v. Anstrue. Mr. Schultz.
Is the court, Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Carmela Laban. In this case, the administrative law judge found that Ms. Laban was limited to sedentary work and therefore disabled as of her 50th birthday in September of 2006. Therefore, Ms. Laban became eligible for supplemental security income benefits. But the ALJ found that she was not disabled prior to her date last insured of September 30th, 2005, and therefore she was not eligible for disability insurance benefits. Ms. Laban claims that the ALJ failed to consider the combination of her extensive medical impairments and history.
Well, the backdating of the medical report, which was essential to her claim, isn't that very damaging to your case?
Well, Your Honor, what actually happened, and I apologize that I didn't see this up until the point that I was preparing for this oral argument, but it appears that the ALJ's office actually sent the doctor a letter saying, we got this report from you and you didn't fill out that one question as to the onset date. And they sent a copy of that letter to the claimant's attorney. It appears then that the doctor filled in a date and sent it back to the Social Security office directly. And then the attorney must have spoken with the doctor and discussed the case, and the doctor then decided that there was an earlier onset date that was appropriate. And then the attorney submitted that report to the ALJ as well. So both of those reports came out of the same request from the Social Security Administration.
I don't understand you. He gets the report, and they ask him for a date, and he fills it in, and then he gives another date.
That's correct. In response to...
Who changed the date?
Well, the doctor put two separate dates, two different dates on two different reports.
So was he asked why he did that?
No, he was not asked.
Well, that's a big gap, isn't it?
I think it is a big gap. I think the ALJ should have... if the ALJ felt that was a reason for rejecting his opinion, he could have contacted him and said, why did you change the alleged onset date? But I don't think it's a basis for rejecting the opinion of a cardiologist who's been treating the claimant for 12 years.
Well, it's pretty suspicious, though, when he backdates it in order to, without that backdating, her claim evaporates. So it's pretty important change that he did.
Well, except even the first date that the doctor put on the form was prior to the expiration of the date last insured. The first date that Dr. Niazi put on his form was that the onset was in February of 2005, which was still not 7 months prior to the expiration of the date last insured.
So you're saying the change didn't make any difference?
Well, it made a difference in not in her eligibility for disability insurance benefits. That's correct. Had the ALJ accepted the onset date of February 2005, Ms. Laban would be eligible for her disability insurance benefits.
Are you saying it made no difference or made?
No, it made a difference because she alleged an onset date of March of 2004, and she would be eligible for benefits at the earliest as of September of 2004. So it made a difference in terms of about 6 months of benefits. That's correct. That's the only difference that it made. In this case, the ALJ really failed to consider the combination of the plaintiff's impairments. At page 22 and 23 of the ALJ's decision, or of the administrative record, is the entirety of the ALJ's discussion of the claimant's credibility and residual functional capacity assessment. As for credibility, the ALJ mentions a few very minor and light daily activities. But what the ALJ fails to mention is that Ms. Laban testified that her typical day was getting up at 6:30 or so, seeing her daughter off to school. She'd have coffee with her husband. Then she would have to lie down for 2 or 3 hours. Then she would get up, do some light housework, maybe have a bite to eat. Then she would lie down for another 2 hours or so in the afternoon. And when her husband and daughter got home, she would tell them how to make dinner or what to make for dinner and how to make it. She went grocery shopping. Her husband did all the lifting. Her husband put the clothes in the laundry for her. She couldn't even do that. And this court has held on many occasions that those types of daily activities that are punctuated with rest, and in this case resting 4 or 5 hours during the course of the day, do not support finding the claimant able to sustain full-time work. So therefore, the ALJ, the only other basis for the ALJ's credibility finding is what he considered that the objective evidence didn't support the claimant's testimony. But an ALJ is not allowed to rely solely on the fact that objective evidence does not fully support a claimant's impairment in order to find the claimant not credible. In this case, I think it's particularly important because the ALJ picked on one of the claimant's impairments, cardiomyopathy and congestive heart failure. And because that condition did improve at one point, the ALJ decided that that meant the claimant's testimony about needing to lie down and her fatigue and weakness was not credible. But Ms. LeBon had other cardiac impairments, which were very severe. She'd been treated for supraventricular tachycardia for many years, and she had to have a defibrillator and pacemaker implanted. And even after that procedure, she continued to have tachycardia and told her doctor that she continued to experience fatigue. The ALJ doesn't address that condition at all in determining whether or not Ms. LeBon was credible. And that's a similar problem in the ALJ's assessment of Dr. Niazzi's report. While the ALJ rejected the report for the confusion on the onset date, he also stated that the doctor's assessment was inconsistent with the improvement in the ejection fraction and, again, the congestive heart failure. But in addition to the tachycardia, Ms. LeBon also suffered from other cardiac conditions, including tricuspid regurgitation, biatrial enlargement, mitral valve problems. And Dr. Niazzi is a cardiologist, and he was in the best position to address what the limitations were from the claimant's cardiac condition. But even on top of that, of course, Ms. LeBon had suffered from two distinct instances of breast cancer with two surgeries and extensive chemotherapy and radiation therapy for that cancer. And no medical opinion was assessed in this case that that condition, combined that treatment, combined with the cardiac status and combined with the extensive cervical and lumbar spine arthritis could not cause the limitations stated by Ms. LeBon and assessed by Dr. Niazzi. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Mr. Marcel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Kurt Marcel appearing on behalf of the Commissioner. I think Your Honor pointed out correctly that the central issue in this case is whether or not the ALJ reasonably rejected Dr. Niazzi's opinion. And the ALJ gave specific, legally defensible, and completely supportable reasons for rejecting that opinion, most specifically that it appeared that he was trying to do a favor for his client, and the record clearly reflects that intent. Indeed, though he backdated his opinion all the way back to May 2004 when LeBon claimed she became disabled, he didn't treat her for any cardiac condition, any of the purported cardiac conditions mentioned this morning or in the briefs, until August or September of 2005. And at that point, LeBon was only referred to him after a CT scan in connection with breast reconstruction surgery. Indicated that she had a cardiac problem. So they did some testing, and they found that she had an ejection fraction of 30 to 35%, and given that low ejection fraction score, that required that she undergo ablation and implantation of a defibrillator.
What about her other condition that Mr. Schultz mentioned, the tachycardia and so on?
The tachycardia that was referenced in LeBon's brief, and that is referenced in the record, is sparse indeed. Yet even that reflects Dr. Niazzi's opinion that it wasn't a significant condition. For example, in November 2003, Dr. Niazzi said regarding her reports of occasional tachycardia, "There's nothing wrong with your heart," he assured her. And she was her heart rate at that point was about 100 to 110 beats per minute, which is just slightly above normal. In May 2004, LeBon told a physician that that she had a normal ejection fraction. In September 2004, Dr. Niazzi ordered an echocardiogram, and he said, "If the ejection fraction is normal, no further treatment is warranted." Simply put, she wasn't seeking treatment for this tachycardia. She reported it occasionally, and Dr. Niazi dismissed it as an insignificant finding, assuming, of course, there was nothing wrong with her ejection fraction. It was only until, or only when, the record testing revealed a problem with ejection fraction that Dr. Niazi felt that Laban required treatment. And that occurred in September of 2005, incidentally the same month her insured status for DIB expired. And as the ALJ reasonably pointed out, her condition improved after she underwent the ablation in 2005 and the implantation of the defibrillator. And by January of 2006, Laban was reporting less shortness of breath, less fatigue, and she in fact indicated that she had no tachycardia since December of 2005. And the record is quite clear after that point in January, we don't have any further reports of tachycardia. True, she did undergo an ablation in April of 2006, but she was released the next day, and during the procedure, an episode of tachycardia completely resolved. Other than that, we have no instances reported of treatment for tachycardia or any other cardiac condition. And as evidence that Laban cited in her brief, which she didn't submit to the ALJ, it makes clear, Laban's ejection fraction improved in January of 2006 to 50, which is about normal. And that's entirely consistent with Dr. Niazi's earlier statement that if she has a normal ejection fraction, there's really nothing significantly wrong with her. And her own report in January of 2006 reflects that with that improvement in her ejection fraction, there simply was nothing wrong with her. With respect to the claim that the ALJ didn't consider her impairments in combination, it's simply not supported by the record. In fact, the ALJ considered each and every impairment she alleged, and admittedly, she had cancer, but that was well in the distant past. Certainly nothing during the relevant time period during her alleged onset of disability, and in spite of that cancer treatment, in spite of the other problems that she alleged, Laban was working 14-hour days in her brother's restaurant until May of 2004. And she testified that she was lifting 25 to 50 pounds at a time until that point in time. She also testified that she cooked, she was on her feet. Simply put, there's nothing in May 2004 to support her claim that she couldn't perform work at that level. There's no medical evidence, certainly, to support it. And in fact, though the ALJ didn't point to this evidence, the record reflects that she told a doctor in 2004 that she quit working for her brother in May 2004 only because he went bankrupt. And it simply had nothing to do with any medical condition. And as the ALJ pointed out, again, it bears repeating, Dr. Niazi simply did not treat Laban at any point until August of 2005 when she was accidentally referred to him, not because of an increase in complained symptoms, but because the diagnostic testing revealed an abnormality that otherwise wouldn't have been revealed. Finally, if I may, just with respect to the credibility assessment, the ALJ plainly considered more than her activities and more than the objective medical evidence. He considered the fact that the record documented sparse treatment for any of her complaints. He indicated that he considered that the medication that she was prescribed was relatively mild, and in fact, she was rarely prescribed medication at all. He also considered the physician opinion reports, which is definitely something that an ALJ is required to consider in evaluating a claimant's credibility. So to suggest that the ALJ simply relied on her daily activities and the objective medical evidence to the exclusion of all other evidence is simply not supported by the record. In conclusion, we ask that the court affirm the ALJ's decision to reject Dr. Niazi's opinion, as well as the nurse practitioner's completely unsupported opinion, and affirm the ALJ's credibility assessment because the ALJ plainly built a bridge between the evidence and his conclusions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Marcel. Mr. Schultz?
The commissioner's statement that Dr. Niazi first saw the claimant in 2005 is wrong. As we point out in our brief, Dr. Niazi's reports indicate he first treated the claimant for her cardiac conditions in 1993, so he had been seeing her for a long time. In addition, Ms. Laban testified or told her doctor that she experienced episodes of tachycardia, racing heartbeat, 3 times a month. And there's evidence in the record that's cited in the brief that after the implantation of the pacemaker, she continued to have over 4 episodes of racing heartbeat every month. The report from Dr. Niazzi that Mr. Marseille referred to, page 583 of the record, the doctor says, I note that the ejection fraction improved, but despite that, that doesn't negate the fact that she has significant atrial arrhythmia and her heart was weakened in the past by her chemotherapy. And from a cardiac perspective, she cannot sit, stand, or walk for more than 2 hours. So the ALJ did not take into consideration the combination of this claimant's impairments, which actually prevented her from sustaining work activity. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, both counsel. Next case for argument, United States.